This is Global Voices Radio.
Here's Paul Nelson.
Today, we look at stories. Like the word myth, stories have gotten a bad name. But a world-renowned storyteller who's collected stories from all over the world says that listening to a good story can be transformative. Laura Sims credits Native American storyteller Vi Hilbert with teaching her
how language itself holds wisdom within it and how the true meaning of a story is unlocked, not through the content and one analyzing the content, but in what happens to the listener.
Laura Sims is the author of The Robe of Love, Secret Instructions for the Heart, and is our guest today. I studied a healing modality years ago that included a model of how consciousness manifests. Deeper than physiology, behavior, thoughts, emotions, and belief systems lies something the teacher called personal mythology. In the introduction of a groundbreaking book of the same name, the writer suggests personal mythology is the vibrant infrastructure that informs your life whether or not you are aware of it. Consciously or unconsciously, you live by your mythology. The trick is to be a master of one's personal mythology, but first that requires figuring it out. Perhaps you remember a favorite story from your youth, a bedtime story that you had your mom or dad read to you over and over. It may be the rare parent today that reads regularly to their child, but somehow stories are very important in determining who we are and what that personal mythology is. Today we chat with a woman who's made collecting and telling stories the focus of her life. The New York Times called her a major force in the renaissance of storytelling in America. Laura Sims is the author of The Robe of Love, Secret Instructions for the Heart. Laura, a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, and I love your introduction.
Made sense to you, huh?
Completely.
You know, sometimes I wonder if people think I'm coming from left field with this stuff, but I saw this book. I've never read the book, and I've known the concept for the last few years. I saw it in a used bookstore, and I thought, I'm buying that book, and it's in good condition, and here it is. So, some kids want to be a teacher or a firefighter when they grow up. When did you know that you wanted to be a storyteller?
Well, I'm not sure I even know that now. But I used to concoct very, very intense stories from the time I was a child in my backyard. All of my friends and my pets were part of the entire event, and particularly really surrounding funerals that I invented. I was very much involved in ritual at an early age. But I was a student of medieval literature. I was an A student. I had a fellowship to go to the University of Toronto, but I left after 3 days, actually, in 1967. Or maybe it was 1968, and embarked on this kind of journey, this unknown journey, within which I met people like Joseph Campbell and Margaret Mead, and somehow became drenched or enticed, completely provoked and seduced by the idea of ritual and storytelling, myth and dance drama. And somehow, out of all of this, I became a storyteller. Now, does that make sense to you?
It makes some sense, but I've got to think that there might have been some kind of maybe a grandmother who was into that, or, you know, a tradition in your family, or your father was very much into literature, that someone helped you plant that seed. Does that make sense?
But it really didn't happen. In fact, I wrote a play a few years ago called Reconciled in the Book of Secrets. I was commissioned to write a play by a traveling Jewish theater about how I became a storyteller. And then I realized that I was not told stories, although the whole idea of narrative and literature was completely important in my childhood. But I think it had to do with this activity that I engaged in as a child of creating narratives, and also this quest, urgent quest I had for ecstasy, which began in my backyard and in the synagogue near where I grew up.
That's very interesting, a quest for ecstasy, which I think somewhere deep down we all share that. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're not aware of it as you were back then. And ritual being a strong part of that. Tell me.
I think that it was a quality of mind. And it was some quality of mind in which I felt wakeful. I can remember being 4 or 5 years old, lying in bed, and suddenly having this kind of like visual waking dream of a mountain range and seeing horses, and on these horses were riders, and then getting up like a sort of like little pilgrim going downstairs in Brooklyn, walking out, and my father saying, "Where are you going?" And my saying, "Out." And then getting outside and realizing that I couldn't find the place I was looking for at all, that I would have to go back and try to get it inside myself. And that's the first moment of recognition of this quest. But it had to do with feeling alive. And when I was when I dropped out of school, I actually took a theater class, which was very daring because, believe it or not, I was extremely shy. And I got a role in an off-Broadway theater very quickly in Manhattan because I had this sort of quality which I have. I can adapt people's accents. And so I had to play the role of a Swedish geisha who was a Native American roller skater. And I was able to go into trance and speak in Swedish and Latin because it was very bogus, although people thought I was terrific at this. And it was an unusual quality. But at any rate, I didn't make any money, which is something that has continued throughout my entire life. I have a completely different source of wealth. And then I had a group of kids that came to take theater lessons with me, and I knew nothing really about theater except for this kind of mad quest of my own and my dream life and my love of ritual. So I engaged them in acting out fairy tales, and we made a show. We went to Central Park on April 15th. It was freezing in the morning, but then suddenly the sun was shining. We had an enormous audience. Everybody loved it. And the kids wanted to do it again, and they felt that it wouldn't be right to do it twice in a row. So if we took a break, that I should do something since I was an actress. But of course, I had nothing to do, so I told a Russian fairy tale that I knew. And everything that I was looking for in theater, in medieval literature, everything that interested me happened between myself and the audience, something that I had to know about. So I went on this quest to find out what happened in that experience between myself and the audience that was so extraordinarily enriching and had that quality of being alive that I had been searching for.
And then you knew you wanted to be a storyteller.
Actually, I decided that night. And there was an old woman who was passing by with a huge bouquet of roses. And her name was the Baroness Dollarup. And she came straight to me and she said, "Darling, you are a storyteller." And I didn't exactly know what it was. But she explained that she had sat on Hans Christian Andersen's knee when she was 5 years old. And she was passing by in the park and had been responsible for many things in Central Park. And that idea stuck. And so I decided that night to become a storyteller.
This notion of having this in your head, this place with mountains and horses that you wanted to visit, and living in Brooklyn, you know, we can just imagine that. But talking about imagining that, what a rich, tremendously rich imagination from a very early age.
Well, I really believe that everyone has that, that that is our inherent quality. And in fact, The Robe of Love, which is a book that actually, that I didn't want to write, but my editor, who was at the time the editor at Parabola magazine, where I've worked for many years, said that I was always telling love stories and that they were kind of spiritual quests and that I should put them all together and make a book. So I actually, being I'm very disobedient, which makes me a very obedient person, wrote the book, and it took several years. And then I realized that within these stories was that place. Actually, I was in love with stories from the Caucasus, from the Ossetian and Circassian, and Romania, where I now work in Romania 4, 5, 6 times a year. That whole area around the Black Sea and the mountains. If I could make a painting of that dream that I had when I was a little girl, it would be those mountain areas where these stories that I tell take place, which seem to be fantasy, but are the inner reality, those places that wake up our capacity to see with very clear eyes the world that we do live in and turn our lives into the kind of meaning of fairy tale.
We're talking with Laura Sims. She's a storyteller, and she's the author of The Robe of Love, Secret Instructions for the Heart. I'm Paul Nelson. LauraSims.com, Sims with two M's, if you'd like more information on the World Wide Web. What about, you know, telling the story is a lot like trying to explain yoga. You know, you really want to know what it's like, start doing some postures, some stretches. Could you tell a story from the book?
Well, many of these stories are quite long, but I'll tell you a part of a story. The book is named after a particular story that's very much like Psyche and Eros. It's a story of a merchant who had three daughters, and he wanted his whole life to go on a pilgrimage to Mecca. But because the wife, who is never mentioned in the story, and that's often the case, therefore we know exactly what's missing and necessary in the entire quest, he goes off on this quest promising his daughters gifts from a market. And the youngest daughter says she doesn't want the necklace and the bracelet. She wants Kaftan El Hub, the robe of love. So he can't find it. And through a strange series of meetings, he actually, beneath a river, meets the king of jinns. And the king of jinns says, if your daughter wants Kaftan El Hub, the robe of love, she must take this piece of sandalwood incense, light it, and when the smoke rises, her journey will begin. At any rate, she agrees, receiving this, which her sisters are quite amazed at, to go and live with the jinns, where she's promised that she will have the robe of love. It's her quest. It's her desire for her heart's wish, her heart's desire. And the story goes on in which she lives with an old woman in a palace beneath the sea, and there's no husband. And her sisters are dying to know, like, what? You know, what happened? You know, what's he's like? You know, what's this guy like? She's the youngest. We're the oldest. We should be married. And so therefore they call her. And when she comes back, she says, you know, there's no guy. There is no. And they say, there has to be. And she says, well, actually, the old woman gives me some tea every night. I go to sleep and I dream of a man. That's just fine. And they say, don't drink the tea. So she doesn't. And that first night, not drinking the tea, a young man actually comes to the bedroom. And he lies down beside her, unknowing that she's awake. She's never slept with a man before, so she was quite astonished and curious, took a candle so she could look at his face. And he was so noble, so beautiful, she thought she'd just look a little further. And right over his heart, she saw a silver door with a tiny little silver key. So she opened the lock, and there was a porch and a silver staircase. So she jumped onto the porch and went down the steps. And there was a vast garden. Inside was a palace. And in the middle of that palace, she came to a domed room that was completely empty. And in there, she felt such peace. She wanted to stay for a long time, but she realized she couldn't, because what if he woke up? So she ran out, and she went up the stairs. She jumped up the porch, got out of the heart, closed the door, put on the little key, but dropped some hot tallow on him, and he woke up. And then every night they made love and they talked. But when she fell asleep and woke up in the morning, he was gone. Some would think that's perfect. But that's how the story begins. And I don't want to tell the rest of the story, but it's really quite an extraordinary story. And about inside and outside, and how do you find your heart's desire?
Which is exactly what I was going to say, talking about the heart's desire. You know, in the acknowledgments of the book, you cite Vi Hilbert as helping to nurture your ability to see beneath the surface of stories and to bring them to life. Can you tell us about Vi, who you just spent some time with, and about this ability? It's you know, I think in literature we call it subtext. That's part of what we're talking about here.
Well, I met Vi quite by accident once with her main student, Rebecca Chamberlain, at the University of Washington at a women's conference on women in story many years ago here nearby in Seattle. And Vi is an elder of the Lushootse tribe of the Salish Nation. She devoted herself to storytelling and to the Lushootse language, although both of her parents were medicine people, but she didn't want to accept that. She felt that the most enduring thing she could do is keep language alive. And meeting Vi was kind of treasure. She was like one of the old women you meet in the story who somehow opens the door for you, like the old woman who actually is in the castle where beneath the sea that this young girl in Robe of Love meets. Vi taught me many things, and among them was her dedication to not looking at just the surface meaning of the story, but how language itself holds wisdom within it, and how the true meaning of a story is unlocked, not through the content and one analyzing the content, but in what happens to the listener. And that's been my main study, and she's been a great supporter of mine in realizing that that's not cultural for us. We think the story is a text. So we're always looking at the text, analyzing the text, and thinking that somebody is telling us a story. But half the story remains hidden. It's what happens in the mind of the listener, where the story is enacted, that actually the meaning rises up between the listener and the teller. And that's something that's known to traditional people who are great storytellers like Vi.
And in the literature community, you go to a workshop and you know, you're around people who haven't written as much, maybe young people, and one of the suggestions is show, don't tell, because it's a two-way thing. You want to give enough so that they get engaged in the story, but not too much where you're just basically telling them. Otherwise, it becomes an editorial rather than art. You know, in the introduction, author and naturalist Terry Tempest Williams said when she first heard you telling stories over 20 years ago, it wasn't what she heard exactly, but what she felt, that your voice transcended thought.
She's very kind.
She's kind, but you know, but there's truth to that. Can you tell us about that? What you think she meant by that?
Well, I think that there is such a thing as authentic voice when you speak directly from the body, where the intellectual content of language is suffused with the knowledge and with the intention of the storyteller. It is direct. It's like transmission. It's direct. So there's a lot of spaciousness, and there's the true voice that resonates from the body, and that has its own story. What you said at the very beginning, for instance, that everybody has a story that they're really living. Very often the story that we're living is obstructed by stories that we've told ourselves that keep us from discovering the kind of mythos of our life, which is our liberation story. So I know I'm leaping away from what Terry said, but what interests me about voice, and I have done a lot of work in listening and really opening my body and my voice, and a lot of that has to do with meditation, is because in a certain way I tell stories to actually destroy stories, to destroy the stories that we get fixed in, so that we open up the place in ourselves where we are living more mythically. It kind of stops the fixation. You know, now I work in Romania, and I work with gypsy women, with Roma women, and they're filled with despair, and I work so with war victims and trauma. And I tell stories, and very often I realize my job, it's not the content that this story is telling you something. It's that what happens to you is that it frees up that place where you can have alternative thinking, where your mind and body are synchronized, where there's a kind of the actual genuine imagination, which is like nowness, is awakened. Once the great meditation teacher Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche was talking, and he was talking about imagination, and I asked, what is imagination? And he said, nowness. And it kind of just, my mind just like blew open, thinking, I always thought of imagination as the kind of ceaseless display that we come up with. And it is that, but that ceaseless display is not fixed. It's more the activity of what's happening than the content of what's happening that the voice can liberate.
Gary Snyder calls it the mythological present. That's his term for it, and I think that really fits.
Yes.
And I think what we're beginning to understand is it's a I don't want to say altered state of consciousness, but in a way an altered state of consciousness, a different state of consciousness than the one that we're in when we're paying bills or daydreaming about bad things that are happening, or think worries for that mm-hmm. for that matter. Would you agree that it's an altered state when people are deeply in listening, involved in a story?
Alter in that it would be the Germanic older. But I think it's more original. It's that we are in an altered state or a limited state when we're doing those other things. We don't have to be. But I think that we're quite addicted to not use being fully present. And so we think of that as altered. But I wouldn't say that's altered. I would say that's more normal, in which we're both dreaming wide awake and completely aware. The eyes of perception, or as Vi calls it, the spiritual eyes are open. So, but it does have a sense, you know, when you're listening, when you're involved in the listening to a story, or you're listening to a great poet like Gary Snyder, even his ordinary conversation is like that, there is a sense of... you feel suddenly wide awake. It's like enlightened gossip. Suddenly you're present. You're really there, and everything is very vivid. The details of the world, like the blue around you that people can't see, it's very vivid because we're having a good conversation, and that has to do with the fact that we're connecting and it's empty, and that would be my blessed wish for everybody who's listening.
Yeah. As is the regular wish of this program. Again, from the book's introduction, it is in the power of story to remind us what we have forgotten, what we need to remember to restore our hearts. I read this, and this is the third time in, I think, about 3 or 4 weeks that this notion, maybe longer than that, that this notion that we've forgotten something, we've become disconnected for some reason, and it's the story that brings us back there. How important is this for people in a country who, for the first time in their history, have supported, with their public support, a preemptive war?
Well, I would say that it's exquisitely important, if not urgently important, to be engaged in genuine story, as opposed to having the mind seduced by anecdote and litany of events that doesn't come from an authentic voice. So the psychic confusion is a kind of torment. I feel that there's that we have achieved a kind of addiction in which we must feel physically something's off, but we're so accustomed to that going from the place of sort of unnatural mental fixation on something to full presence almost would feel daring, painful, like you had to cross a great ravine, as if you could lose control, when actually, when you're present, you're really there with your life so fully. But I do think that people are mistaking story for a kind of inauthentic manipulation of information. And information is very different from story, which is an experience. And when you hear it, even if you don't understand it, you know it's true.
You know, it's very interesting how the word myth has been twisted in our time. That myth means a lie, means something bogus, where, you know, news means something real, and it's sort of like the mm-hmm. inversion of reality. Very interesting. I think someone on the show described, a child described what myth is. It's something that's not true on the outside, but true on the inside.
That's right? Great.
So we're out of time for this segment. I can refer people to your website, laurasims.com.
Thank you.
LaurasImms.com. We'll have a link on our website. And remind you again that we're talking with Laura Sims. She's a storyteller. She's the author of The Robe of Love, Secret Instructions for the Heart.